This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll hear from East Baton Rouge Parish Councilwoman Donna Collins-Lewis on her attempt to have former city employees not take retirement and then return to work with the city in another capacity while receiving benefits. Also, author Kate Moore on her appearance at the Maine East Baton Rouge Library on Goodwood this Saturday to discuss her book, The Radium Girls. Sarah McBride, the first transgender person to speak at a national convention, she did so in 2016 at the Democratic Convention, talks about her life that is detailed in Tomorrow Will Be Different. And veteran actress Joyce Bulifant, who was in Hollywood for many years, is still there as a matter of fact, has written about her odyssey that includes some turbulent marriages to some famous men in show business. We'll get a glimpse from her amazing life. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we start our conversation today with Donna Collins-Lewis, the East Baton Rouge Parish Metro Council member. She has a proposal that was shot down last week, but she says she'll be back, that would cut down, in fact, stop the people from getting retirement benefits after retiring from the city and then coming back and working in another capacity and getting paid while they're receiving their retirement. What do you think? We'll talk about it with Donna Collins-Lewis, and your number is 877-217-5757, and locally 297-5633. You can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. And good morning to you, Councilwoman Donna Collins-Lewis.
Good morning, Jim.
Why did you decide to pursue this? Is this a big problem?
Well, when I first decided to pursue it, I did not realize that it was a problem. I was approached by someone within a small city parish department. Young lady who was in a position there, had maxed out in her pay grade, could not go anywhere else. Her supervisor was retiring, and the young lady at that point felt that at least she could be considered for the supervisory position. And from what I was told, the supervisor had decided that she was going to retire, but that she was going to come back into her same position, which meant that the young lady would be stuck where she was. And so I just started, that's how I got started with this. Just thought I'd do a little investigating in it and try to see if we can make some changes there.
Well, you brought it before the council last week, and the proposal did not get approval, but you say you're not stopping.
No, as a matter of fact, I'm still doing research. I'm going to continue with it. I didn't think that it would pass that night. I had given my colleagues an opportunity to weigh in when I first put the ordinance out there, made some revisions to it. They deferred it for 60 days. Still didn't get a lot of feedback from anyone except for a couple of council members, and then when we got on the floor, wasn't a lot of discussion from them because I think their minds had already been made up. Some of them were saying that this, we already have something in place where these people can be fired. But the whole reality of it, Jim, is that supervisors within departments, except for at the mayor's discretion, can say who can retire and who can come back and what position they can come back in. There's no policy. There's no equity in it. And so it's left at the discretion of the supervisor. If I like you, you can come back. If I don't like you, if I feel like I don't want you back or whatever. And so there needs to be some policy in place. One of the other issues I had with it when I started digging into this, which I didn't know, I didn't really fully understand DROP. But from what I understood, the DROP program was designed to allow people to go into the DROP for 3 to 5 years, put money into an account, which would be, people would invest the money and they could, get the interest off of it, then use that money and retire. And so they were supposed to retire after the 5 years. If you did not retire, you'd lose all the interest on your DROP account. And so some people decided to retire. And what they did was retire from the city because you had to separate to get your DROP money. So they retired, some of them, for 30 days and turned around and came right back to the city as rehires. So they have their DROP money, they have their retirement account with the city, and now they're coming back part-time in some high-level positions making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And I just don't think it's a good policy. I don't think it's a policy at all, really.
877-217-5757 for Donna Collins-Lewis, East Baton Rouge Parish Metro Council woman, and she is saying that this is a policy that's being abused. How many people are involved, do you know?
There's probably around 50, I'm going to look at my list, I think it's around 50 or maybe 75 people that are involved. with some of these people, Jim, have worked for the city in excess of 35 and 40 years. And so they were asking me about grandfathering people in. But if we grandfather people in, that means that the people that are there that have already been here 35 and 40 years can just stay for as long as they want to stay. And my goal was to create opportunities for other people within departments to move into other positions. So because everybody wants to do the same thing that these people have done, be promoted into a top-level position, get your salary up so that you can have a comfortable retirement also.
Elizabeth on I-10. Good morning, Elizabeth. You're on the air with Councilwoman Lewis, Collins Lewis. Donna Collins Lewis is at your service. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Elizabeth.
I actually work for the city, and I have mixed feelings about it just because when I was hired, I had a manager that hired me who went in the drop and then came back, and during her busy time, she has been instrumental and while she was paid part-time, she never actually worked part-time, and someone filled her position as a manager, and she was able to help the other employees because she was no longer having to fulfill the duties of a manager, but she had that wealth of knowledge of her 30 years of experience.
All right. She says, Elizabeth does, that there are cases where this is advantageous. Would you quarrel with that?
Well, this is I'm not going to say quarrel with that, but my problem is with that. If someone has been in city parish government for 30 years, they should be training someone else to take their position. So to me, people monopolize on knowledge, and they've been talking about this institutional knowledge within departments. But if that knowledge is never shared with other people in departments, then they never have the opportunity to move into positions. And I'm not saying that this particular person did that. You know, they can come back. One of the things that my ordinance does not do is does not stop people from coming back. It stops people from coming back into full-time positions as part-time employees. And many of them will say, well, I really work full-time. So you're not required to work full-time. So at any given moment, you can say, well, I'm not coming today because I'm just part-time. Mm-hmm. And so, again, people are in these full-time. If the finance director and any other director's position is full-time, why do we have part-time people working in full-time positions?
877-217-5757 or 297-5633. Still time to get in with Donna Collins Lewis or send us an email at talk@talklouisiana.org. Donna Collins Lewis is trying to curb what she says is an abuse by some people, somewhere around 50 to 75 people, she says, are getting retirement benefits and coming back and working for the city, sometimes at lucrative positions that are paid as though they're still part of the workforce, which they are, while receiving their benefits. That's the key. What about suspending the benefits if they come back? Would that be an acceptable compromise?
That's an acceptable compromise, but they don't want to, and that is therein lies the issue. Again, I'm not trying to stop the administration. That was another problem people had. Well, I don't want to tell the mayor who she can hire. I'm not trying to tell the mayor who to bring back or who not to bring back. If they come back, they need to come back as a full-time employee and suspend their retirement. They're coming back into a full-time position. So suspend the retirement and come back full-time. But they don't want to do that. If you're drawing money from your drop account, if you're drawing your retirement in excess of $100,000 a year and you're making another $100,000 with the city of Baton Rouge, why would you want to change it?
How many years Councilwoman, how many years do you have to work for the city to receive retirement benefits?
I'm not sure, but I think you can retire with some benefits at 15 years maybe. Some of these people on here have been here like maybe 12, 15 years, but there's only a percentage of their retirement. Some of these people are retiring with 80% of their retirement benefits. Another $100,000 working part-time.
Well, okay, to get 80%, how long do you have to work for the city?
I'm not really sure on the 80%. I'm not sure.
All right, Barry in Mid-City.
So I don't want to give you wrong information.
I understand. Barry in Mid-City, you're on the air with Donna Collins Lewis. Hi, Barry.
Hey, good morning, and thank you, Councilwoman, for proposing your ordinance.
Thank you.
I believe it would be a very financially responsible step for the city of Baton Rouge, and I'm having difficulty understanding why there would be opposition, please.
Well, again, if you're working part-time, making 90-plus thousand a year, and you're drawing a retirement of another 100-plus thousand a year, and you're getting money from a drop account, why would you want to retire? Why would people want to leave? I mean, to me, it's selfish and not wanting to allow other people the opportunity to be considered for those positions. And I have been approached since I started this with people in city parish departments that have come to me privately and said, this is the same thing that's happening in my department. Please don't stop. Please continue to go with it because something needs to be done.
Well, this has gotten some pushback, as these kinds of things do. You say you're coming back with this in a couple of months?
Yes, I am. I'm continuing to study and to look at it to make some different changes in it, but not a lot. I'm not willing to grandfather everybody in indefinitely. The ordinance did allow for people to have a year from the time that the ordinance would be put in place if it had passed to be able to transition out of those positions. And so they would still have time to train or begin to train or mentor someone. But if you've been there 30 and 35 years and you have no one to take your place, but the other thing, some of those departments, and I'm not beating up on any department, but finance department has the director and the assistant director who are both retired rehires. And so where are you bringing up other people to take these positions?
We have some inquiries online. One is, how many hours constitutes a full-time worker, according to the city?
Well, that's another issue. I met with personnel, and those positions say full-time, but there's no hour indication in the position. That's another thing that I'm looking at. If it is a full-time position, normally a full-time position is anywhere from 32 to 40 hours a week. That's not in the job description within City Parish government. But these people are below they're at 29, so they're considered part-time. Anything I'm thinking over that is why they get that's where the loophole is. They're allowed to work part-time.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Donna Collins-Lewis after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Sasha Kabalshaw is producing today, and do we have Donna Collins-Lewis, East Baton Rouge Parish Councilwoman, with us for a few more minutes, and then we'll be joined by the author Kate Moore, who will be appearing at the East Baton Rouge Parish Library. But the Metro Council last week got the initial salvo from Councilwoman Donna Collins-Lewis, who is up in arms about some people in our government, city government, who are coming back to work for the city and getting paid, in some cases, rather handsomely, while receiving their retirement benefits. And so far, it appears that this may be a big hill to climb for the Metro Council. What's your take on whether this is something that has traction, or is this going to be dead on arrival, Councilwoman?
Well, I've had some correspondence with a couple of my colleagues after the ordinance failed. They do believe that there is something that needs to happen with this. They want to possibly look at putting together a committee to see how we can move forward with it. But some of them are in agreement that there needs to be change within this. And again, they're talking about the policy. There is no policy, and therein lies a part of the problem. There's no policy that says how this is done. I'll give you one other for instance. That was one young lady who retired from her position in the budget office. She wanted to come back full-time. They allowed her to come back, but the position that she was in, they promoted someone else from another department within that position, and they allowed her to come back at a lower pay. That's not done for everybody. So I don't know how they're determining, except for the supervisor's discretion, as to who comes back into what position at what level.
So many people are coming back
in the same position.
Right. 877-217-5757 for Donna Collins-Lewis. Ray in Prairieville. Hi, Ray. You're on the air with Councilwoman Collins-Lewis.
Thanks for taking my call, Jim. Before I address the question to the Councilwoman, I want to congratulate you on the recent Tiger Rags March issue with the specialties on Shaquille O'Neal.
Well,
I think that is really an excellent issue, and I'll probably go down and pick up a second one for the kids.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your kind words, and so does the staff at Tiger Rag. All right, Ray, on this issue.
For the councilwoman, I think she's taken a very good approach, but I think as part of that, I'd like to hear her address whether we should change the retirement age of many of these government positions so many people, 30 and out is not appropriate these days. It should be 65, mandatory retirement type of thing, instead of just 30 and out. I'd like to hear her response on that, and I'll take it on here.
Let me get what you're saying correct. You're saying people should be required to retire at 65?
No. I'm just saying that they should not be retiring a lot earlier than that and then staying on the job as a second income.
All right. Well, some people start their work lives early. And they
start, very early.
And they stay in the same place, and they're good workers. And if they put in 30 or 40 years, then God bless them. I don't see any problem with them getting their retirement benefits, Ray. But there might be an issue to get retirement and also get paid on top of that. And that's what Donna Collins-Lewis is addressing.
Exactly.
You're not going to get into the other subject. I imagine that one would really have some pushback.
That would have some pushback, and so there are lots of people, like you said, started city fair government at a very early age. They're not even at retirement age when they get to that to 30 years, and so that's a whole nother issue.
Phil in Jefferson Parish or Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Tillman. It's a I don't know. It's happy spring, and I'm just calling in to say that I'm going to be joining the March 24th to march out and support the kids and gun control. Thanks.
All right. Well, that's a different topic. Thank you for calling. Bill in Sherwood. Hi, Bill. Good morning to you.
Hey, I support the councilwoman's efforts 100%. You know, it's a well-known strategy in city government employment that you set up a job that only you know. You retire from that job, and you get hired back because they can't fill that position with somebody else that knows what you know. And this is double dipping to the max.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Do you view it that way, Donna Collins-Lewis?
I do. Again, when we talk about they talk all the time about the institutional knowledge. But again, if you've been there for 30 years and there are other people under you that have been there for 10 or 15 years, you should have somebody in place. You know that you're not going to be there forever. Nobody is indispensable. You know, and I had to tell somebody, and I mentioned this at the council meeting, if one of us drop dead today or tomorrow, those departments are going to continue. They're going to find somebody else in there to continue the work. No department in city affairs government has shut down because somebody either retired or died. And so it's the same thing. So we say institutional knowledge and the people coming back, that's fine. Come back full time, give up your retirement benefits while you're working full time, and then do it that way. But to come back, work part-time and make that kind of money and then draw your city fair's retirement, that's just a little bit much for me.
All right. We've got a few questions from listeners. This one from Stephanie. Does the state have similar provisions as the city?
They do in some instances, and I know that some of the teachers were not, because some of the teachers I've spoken with also, and they're impacted. They can't just retire and come back like that.
Okay.
So we're trying, that's some of the research that we're looking at. How are other municipalities doing it? What's happening in state government, and how is it working?
And also, lastly, about discouraging new blood, does this, with people who've been in government for a long time coming back, does it preclude people coming in who are fresh faces and maybe have new ideas and different approaches?
It definitely does. I'm not going to ever call people's names, but since I put this out there, I've had a couple of people from different departments that have called or worked for city parish government that have left for the same reason. They felt that they had nowhere to go.
Well, thank you, Donna Collins-Lewis. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and we'll follow this with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kate Moore is with us. She's an author from England who will be in Baton Rouge Saturday, Main Library, 7 o'clock. Her book that she'll be discussing is Radium Girls, which tells the story behind the women who made the numbers glow on watch faces. And Kate Moore, good morning to you. It's nice to hear Kate Moore.
Hi. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell us about, it's been a few years since Radium Girls, but it's an important work and one that you'll be discussing and certainly involves some strong women.
It certainly does. This is a remarkable true story of women fighting for their rights and leaving us with a legacy that we still benefit from today. It's a really important story about remarkable young women.
You came upon this how?
Well, yes, as you can tell, I'm from England, from my accent, and I discovered this little-known piece of American history through directing a play about the girls, which is called These Shining Lives by Melanie Marnich. And I just became entranced with this story. It resonated with me. As I say, it's a story of strong women, of sacrifice, of courage, because these women were poisoned by the work that they were doing. And so they had to fight their companies, you know, for justice, to hold them to account and protect other people. And so it resonated with me as a play. And I started doing research because I knew the play was based on a true story and I wanted to do justice to the real people we were portraying on stage. And I realized there was no book that was actually focused on the individual women themselves, Catherine Donohue, Grace Fryer. And I thought that was wrong. I thought these women deserved a book that celebrated them, you know, the humanity of them, the heartbreak of this story, and the incredible legacy that they've left us. And so that's why I wrote the book and how I discovered their story.
Well, this is part of the One Book, One Community celebration of Hidden Figures, and The Radium Girls is another book about strong women. And this was a major innovation.
It was. So it's crazy as it sounds to us today. The women were working with radium paint, radioactive radium paint. But in the 1910s and the 1920s, people actually thought that radium was not only safe to work with, but actually beneficial to health. And so people would be, you know, consuming it as a health tonic.
Well, the book is important, and it is certainly a great story about some fascinating and strong women who made the numbers glow on watch faces. Radium Girls from Kate Moore, and Kate will be with us Saturday, 7 o'clock, Main Library at Goodwood. Thank you for joining us today, Kate Moore.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
We'll be back after this news break on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Our local dial is in Baton Rouge, is 297-5633, and we're joined by Sarah McBride, a fascinating person, the National Press Secretary at the Human Rights Campaign. And her book is Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality, a captivating memoir that perhaps will change the way that people look at identity and equality in this country. She became the first transgender person to speak at a national political convention in 2016 at the age of 26. Sarah, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's an amazing odyssey, your life, and tell us about how this has evolved over the last few years for you.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, even for a 27-year-old, I've had quite a bit of life, particularly in the last 6 years. This book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, is the story of my journey as a transgender woman, my journey as an advocate, my journey from coming out as transgender while I was serving as student body president at American University to having the opportunity to be the first transgender woman to work in any capacity at the White House when I interned there, to fighting for equality in my home state of Delaware and around the nation, to the romance between me and my late husband, Andy, who was a transgender man and fellow advocate who passed away from cancer, unfortunately, just a couple days after we married in 2014. I was just going to say the book traces our romance, and you know, at the end of the day, my hope is that the book can reinforce for folks that behind this national conversation on transgender rights are real people who love and laugh, hope and dream, fear and cry, just like everyone else.
Tell us about Andy.
Andy was just good down to his core. He was about 3 years older than me. He was a lawyer by training, but he used his law degree to advocate to expand health care access to LGBTQ people across the country. He was someone who was passionate about equality. He had a great sense of humor. He was incredibly motivated and passionate about the work, about his friends. But more than anything else, he was just so kind. And in an era of leaders and elected officials who so often appeal to the darkest undercurrents and our most basic instincts, I want people to know about this most incredible, kind human being.
Your Facebook post announcing your revelation went viral. Were you amazed at the attention you received?
You know, I understood when I was preparing to come out, since I was serving as student body president, that this was going to be news, that it was going to be something that people were going to talk about. And frankly, that's one of the reasons why I decided to write it in a public note and then eventually have it as an op-ed in the student newspaper, because I understood that in getting my story out there in my own terms, that it would help to humanize not just my experience, but the experience for other transgender people. But what was really heartening was that the response was not just significant, it was significantly positive. Every single response that came in was a message of love and support from people across campus and really outside across the country. And I think this is 2012, and on that day, my peers at American University were sending a signal to the country, which is that we still may be learning what it means to be transgender. We may not even be able to wrap our minds around it, but this is how you respond when someone in your life comes out, with love, with respect, with affirmation.
The book is Tomorrow Will Be Different from Sarah McBride. The foreword is by Joe Biden. 877-217-5757 if you'd like to get in while we have time with Sarah, and what a story it is. Sarah writes that we must never be a country that says there's only one way to love, only one way to look, and only one way to live. That said, I think you would be the first to acknowledge that there is a rampant discrimination against mm-hmm. people of all kinds in this country, but particularly against transgender people.
That's exactly right. To this day, far too many transgender people face discrimination in the workplace and housing and public spaces. Last year, 2017, was the deadliest year on record, as at least 28 transgender people, mostly trans women of color, were killed. To this day, a majority of states, including Louisiana and the federal government, still lack clear protections from discrimination throughout daily life for transgender people. And that reality only emboldens the discrimination. Far too many are rejected by their family. They face harassment for merely walking down the street as the person they are. And at the end of the day, we have never, ever regretted siding with kindness over hate, with inclusion over discrimination. And I think that, again, while people may still be just beginning to learn about what it means to be transgender, what we know throughout our history, throughout our country's journey toward a more perfect union, is that discrimination never wears well in history, that we always regret discrimination. And at the end of the day, that's what you need to know, that transgender people are people. They deserve to be treated with dignity and respect and fairness. We deserve to be equal under the eyes of the law and by society. And that's what this work is about. That's what the work that I'm doing at the Human Rights Campaign is about, to make sure that LGBTQ people, no matter who you are or who you love, that you have the same opportunities as everyone else, that you're judged on your merit, not on your identity, and that you can live as much of your life as your authentic self as possible. And I think that's what anyone, no matter their sexual orientation, gender identity, wants for their time on this earth.
How challenging was your life when you were going through this process of identity?
You know, it's a good question. And I think one of the challenges we have in this fight for trans equality, which is different than the effort for my community members who are not transgender, who are gay, lesbian, and bisexual, is that most people who are straight, who are heterosexual, understand what it feels like to love and to lust. And that provides an entry point of empathy into the experience, into the lives, into the needs of gay and lesbian people. But for transgender people, the non-transgender population doesn't have an analogous experience. And so for me, the best way I can describe it growing up with this struggle with my gender identity was a constant feeling of homesickness, an unwavering ache in the pit of my stomach that would only go away when I could be seen and affirmed as myself. And that pain eventually became all-encompassing. It eventually became something that I thought about every single waking hour of every single day. And we know, as transgender people, the medical community, the scientific community, the research community has affirmed this, that the only way to alleviate, the only way to solve, to address that pain is for transgender people to be able to be, live, and affirmed as the gender identity they know themselves to be.
some questions from listeners, and one asks about Caitlyn Jenner. Have you been following Caitlyn's process?
Well, I certainly, yeah, as a opponent of news and admittedly a fan of reality television, I had been following Caitlyn's journey even before she came out, when she was still the clumsy step-parent on Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And you know, I think that Caitlyn Jenner is someone who I certainly don't see eye-to-eye on every issue, but that certainly doesn't require me to have compassion. That doesn't get in the way of me being joyful and excited for her to be able to live her authentic self. We very much disagree in our politics. We very much disagree in terms of who we support in politics. But what her coming out did is that it provided an opportunity for discussions that in far too many places weren't happening. And I think one of the most powerful things was on the night she came out in that ABC special. Right after she came out, the local ABC stations across the country featured stories about local transgender people in their own communities, telling their stories, demonstrating that we exist everywhere in this country, demonstrating that we come in all different kinds of identities and backgrounds. And I think that that was a powerful mm-hmm. moment for our country in our journey towards education.
Another question, how much of a distraction has this bathroom issue been?
That's a great question. And I think I really like the way it's framed, because so often I get questions, why do you all keep talking about bathrooms? And I like the way this question was framed as a distraction, because transgender people would rather not be talking just about bathrooms. We'd rather be talking about dignity and fairness throughout daily life. And yes, of course, that includes in restrooms, but we need it throughout our lives. The reality is that opponents of equality are the ones that are focusing in on restrooms. And the reason why is twofold. The first is that everyone feels a little bit vulnerable in restrooms. And so opponents of equality recognize that restrooms are fertile ground to stoke fears, spread misinformation, and prey on the still lackness in too many places across this country around transgender identities. But it's also a little bit more insidious than that. It goes beyond just political messaging. And the reason why opponents of equality are focusing so much on bathrooms,
there you go,
is that throughout every single battle for civil and human rights, opponents of equality have focused in on bathrooms. They did it with the Civil Rights Act. They did it with the Equal Rights Amendment. They did it in the early days of the gay rights movement. They did it in response to the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they're doing it today with transgender people. And they do it because they understand that if they lose on everything else, if they lose and we are protected from discrimination in everywhere but bathrooms, they still in many ways win, because bathrooms are the closest thing to a silver bullet to legislating people into the shadows. Because if you can't use a restroom that makes sense for you, if you can't access a restroom easily and safely that makes sense for you, it becomes much more difficult to go to work, to go to school, or to really leave your house for more than a few hours. And so these efforts are nothing more than a thinly veiled attempt to push transgender people out of public life. And we need our allies to recognize that while it may seem silly, and it's certainly not transgender people who are focusing in on restrooms, we need folks to understand just how dangerous that North Carolina-style anti-LGBTQ, anti-trans bill was, and how dangerous it is in any other place it's introduced.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah McBride. An important book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. It's been a pleasure. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we hope you're having a good day today. Unfortunately, in the state of Maryland, there's been another school shooting, and information right now is a bit sketchy, but there will be reports throughout the day from WRKF and National Public Radio about what's happening in Maryland, and we will follow it. We were scheduled to be joined by Joyce Bulafont, the veteran actress, and right now we're a little behind schedule. At least Joyce is not where we thought she would be at this point, but if we grab her, we'll certainly talk with her. And she's a fascinating lady. I think many remember her on The Match Game, many other shows. But her book is My Four Hollywood Husbands. So hopefully we'll be able to get in touch with Joyce Bulafont. With this gun violence issue continuing to be pervasive. After all, it was just a month and 6 days ago that we had the terrible tragedy in Parkland, Florida. 17 people died in that tragedy, and it has caused a nationwide discussion about gun regulation. And tomorrow, by the way, Governor John Bel Edwards will be with us for his monthly show at 2 p.m. on WRKF, and I'm sure there will be some questions about this issue. So we will talk about that some more tomorrow, and I understand we have the remarkable Joyce Bulifant with us. And Joyce, let's see here. Sasha, I'm having a bit of a problem bringing her up. There she is. Hi, Joyce. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I recognize your distinctive voice, and you're also one of the most familiar television faces of all time. And her book is My Four Hollywood Husbands. And people may not realize it, but you were married to some men who were icons in Hollywood. Tell us about the four husbands.
Oh, my goodness. Well, the first one was James MacArthur, and he was, I think most known in later years as Dano on Hawaii Five-0, the original.
Book'em Dano.
Book'em Dano. And he did a lot of Disney films while we were married. That was really fun because we traveled all over. And then I've got to think a minute.
Well, you were married to William Asher, who was also married to Elizabeth Montgomery.
That's right. And that was he was a wonderful man and did Bewitched and I Love Lucy and all the beach party movies. He did his resume goes on and on and on. And then Edward Mallory was before that. He was a matinee idol. He was a soap opera star. He played Dr. Bill Horton on Days of Our Lives. And then there was Bill, and then Roger Perry, who that story, our love story, weaves in and out of the book. He was on Star Trek, and he was did a series called Harrigan and Son, and Lucille Ball discovered him. And he's also a composer. He wrote songs for Barbara Streisand and Bing Crosby, and he's written lots of musicals. And, he just did so many things, Arrest and Trial. He did over 300, even more, I think, shows, movies, and everything. He's just done everything. He's a wonderful actor.
The book is My Four Hollywood Husbands from Joyce Bulifant. And Joyce was on many shows through the years. You worked with Mary Tyler Moore and had a famous husband on the small screen in Gavin MacLeod.
Yes, and he lives nearby. We see each other all the time now.
You worked with Bill Cosby. Did you ever have any problems with Mr. Cosby?
Yes, I did. The first Bill Cosby show, where he was a basketball coach, and I was the school guidance counselor.
But he never did anything inappropriate, or did he?
Oh, no, he was very much a gentleman. He did invite me. He had his chef come to the set every day, and he had a suite of dressing rooms, and the chef would make lunch. And one day he invited me to have lunch with the chef and with him. And when I went there, guess who was there?
Who?
Sammy Davis Jr. and Quincy Jones and Bill Cosby and me. And
all right,
he
so
called me the token white. But he was very appropriate, very much a gentleman with me.
Dream lunch. Sammy Davis Jr., Quincy Jones, and Bill Cosby. My goodness.
How about that?
Now, you were on the Match Game for many years, and I'm sure, despite the fact that you've been in many films and television productions, many remember you most for being a panelist on Match Game. And I'm told you said there was some sexual harassment going on the Match Game. Can that be true?
Well, it was it wasn't anything as terrible as we hear of that when has gone on with some women, but it was just inappropriate behavior. When I would try to get from the stage up to my dressing room, there was a very narrow staircase that led up there. And sometimes when I would try to get up there, Gene Rayburn and the producer were coming down, and they would lean up against me and give me a very inappropriate wet kiss. And I was very codependent, which my book is a lot about. And instead of saying, please don't do that, I didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings, so I would just get to my dressing room and go, look, and be very careful and look and make sure they weren't coming down when I was going up. And then there's a story, but you have to read the book about my situation with Richard Dawson.
Really? He was out of control?
It wasn't. I beg your pardon?
He was a bad guy or a good guy?
Not very nice.
Really?
Put it that way.
So Gene Rayburn and Richard Dawson, they were very likable on television, but you're saying there's a story behind the story.
Yes, and it wasn't anything horrible. It was just inappropriate behavior.
Well, today we live in a new world and perhaps a better world, but that kind of behavior would not be tolerated today, and that's a good thing.
No, and it's very difficult, too, to be able to say, please don't do that. I mean, you feel validated, it's just a bad feeling.
Mm-hmm. Understandably so. A listener asked if you were offered the role of Carol Brady that went to Florence Henderson. Is that true on the Brady Bunch?
I wasn't offered it. I was signed and sealed and delivered to play Mrs. Brady. I for 2 weeks went shopping with the wardrobe people and had all my costumes. The little girls were all cast to look like me, and I did all the screen tests with all the different men once I was cast. And then Friday before we started shooting Monday, I was showing the director and the producer, Sherwood Schwartz, the wardrobe. And each time I would come out and say, well, this is the dress she wears at the wedding in the garden, and this is the suit she wears when she's going away on her honeymoon. Every time I came out, they just looked at me. They didn't say anything. They didn't say, what about a dress instead of a suit? What about a different color? They're never happy usually with the first thing that you wear when you come out. And I came out with about the fourth time, and I looked at them and I said, is something wrong? And they said, Joyce, sit down a minute. And I said, we have a problem. And I said, what's wrong? And they said, ABC in New York would like Florence Henderson. She just is off of a film, and they would like for her to do the role. And we're fighting for you. We want you to do it because we want it to be more like the Lucy show. And if Florence does it, it'll be more like the Donna Reed show. And we want the Lucy show. And we have to recast the housekeeper. Because the housekeeper was the straight person to your funny, and Florence is not that much of a comedian, so we're going to have to make the housekeeper funny. And we're just fighting, and we'll know tonight. And that night, Sherwood Schwartz came over to the house and told me that they just couldn't do anything about it, that Florence was going to do it. And But I must say, Monday morning, all the little girls were saying, where's Joyce?
Oh, my.
It was rather shocking, but I said, in my life, I've always felt that when God closes a door, he opens a window.
Well, Joyce, it's been an honor to talk with you. The book is My Four Hollywood Husbands from Joyce Bulifant, and thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Sasha Gabonshaw, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.